Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman. This is episode number 286, and our guest today will be Sean O'Toole with Foreclosure Radar. I think you'll find this to be a very insightful and interesting interview when our guest comes on. But first, just a brief discussion of some specific properties and specific investment opportunities in four or five different markets in which we operate. And I've got one of our investment counselors on the line here with me, and that is Molly. Molly, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jason?
Good, good. And you're talking to me from San Diego, California today. I love this. Geography has become almost meaningless, as I said on one of the recent episodes. It still means something, but geography ain't what it used to be. We're giving another example of that today with you in San Diego, me in Phoenix, and our listeners all over planet Earth. So first of all, you know, let's talk, Molly, about one of our newer markets, and that is Birmingham, Alabama. As most of our listeners know, my mother moved to Alabama several years ago, and I've had her on the show talking about that and how much she loves it there. But she's not in Birmingham. And, you know, I want to talk about Birmingham because this is really one of our bargain-priced markets. Different markets, of course, have different great assets to them and some liabilities to them as well. But one of the big assets that Birmingham has is it's just so inexpensive. I mean, if you're a starting investor or you're the type of investor that likes to accumulate a lot of properties and you want to make them inexpensive properties, and why would you want to do that? Well, one of the reasons is maybe because you just like bulk diversification. So if you want to have, always wanted to have, say, multiple units and apartment buildings, because there, you know, if you have 16 units or 116 units for that matter, and, you know, one or two of them are vacant, not much of your portfolio as a percentage basis is vacant. And you can do that with single family homes in the lower priced markets. So when you look at Birmingham, you're looking at a market that is priced about 50% the price of a comparable property in, say, Phoenix, which is, you know, a market that's very hard to operate in. And it's about maybe $40,000 less on average than a property in Atlanta. And really, it's about half the price of Dallas in many cases. So again, this is kind of a bargain market. But Molly, what are some of the highlights of the Birmingham market, and why would someone want to consider it? And then we'll look at a specific property.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's the largest and most populated city in the state of Alabama. And it's also, as you said, one of the most affordable places to live in the United States right now. I believe the cost of living in Birmingham is about 6.5% less than the average cost in Alabama.
And by the way, we should mention the average cost in Alabama is pretty low to start with. So when you look at that on a national average, which I have a feeling is what you're going to mention next, it's a lot less expensive than the national average. So what's the national number there?
It's 13% less than the national average.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
It's got some great employers. It's got Honda there. It's got Mercedes. It's got universities there. It has Bell South. It has it's a booming business area.
Yeah, yeah. And that economy is pretty diversified, you know, in terms of manufacturing, higher education, medical, banking. Those are really the top employers, but I love manufacturing. That's one of the reasons I really like the South and the Southeast so much. You look at all these auto manufacturers, you know, when we get away from the big three and the old school Detroit economy that's based largely on unions and Democrats, two of my least favorite things. Had to throw that in. And nobody's setting up an auto plant in Michigan anymore, are they? But they are in the South. And, you know, like you said, you've got Honda, you've got Mercedes, and in these right-to-work states that are friendly to employers that don't require people to join a union to get a job, you've just got this burgeoning manufacturing sector, and it's really a great thing. Molly, what about home prices?
Home prices are historically low right now, and over 46% of the local population are currently renting. So that's what makes it just an incredible investment opportunity. That coupled with, as you said, the price points. I talk to investors every day, and I talk to them about the prices in Birmingham. And as you've mentioned on podcasts in the past, people have reverse sticker shock. They think that the price is the down payment when that's the actual full purchase price.
Yeah. You know, that's so funny you say that. With both of us, both you and I being from California, you still in California, I really got my start talking to California investors. Now we have a global audience. We have clients from all over the world. But what I would always say a long time ago to those California investors is I'd say, look, you know, when you're looking at properties on a nationwide basis, be careful taking your California brain to these other markets because everything looks so cheap. And just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's a good investment or a good value. A lot of times it does, but not always. So like you said about reverse sticker shock, I think that's just kind of a funny thing. And, you know, I'll give another story. And having known you for so long, Molly, back when we were in traditional real estate in Irvine, California together, and you worked back in the day at Merrill Lynch and I worked at RE/MAX. This was a long time ago, folks, that we're talking here.
Yeah, that was before Prue bought Merrill Lynch. Oh my gosh, I forgot that.
Well, it was
before. That's a long time ago.
Actually, Molly, it gets worse. It was before the internet.
Okay. Before Al Gore invented it?
Yeah, right. Likely story. The internet was invented at UCLA in 1969. That was really the start of the internet. And Al Gore, I will admit, though, one thing Al Gore did do is he was responsible for promoting the internet. And I believe he actually either was the promoter or the signer on the ARPANET bill, formerly internet that was just for really defense to the public sector. So got to give him a little credit as much as I don't like Al Gore. But what were we actually saying there? Here we are on a tangent. Oh yeah, reverse sticker shock. So you probably experienced this too, although I never talked to you about it specifically, but I sure did. When I would work with relocation clients as a traditional realtor, that their companies would say, hey, back in the day when companies actually used to move to California, that really doesn't happen anymore. Now they just leave California. But back in the day, you know, companies would move to California and they would send their employees, their executives, out to look at property in Southern California. And I remember touring people around that were from other states all across the country, and they'd come out and they'd look at property, and they had massive sticker shock, Molly. I mean, where they were just thinking, gosh, I have to spend 3, 4, even 5 times what my home is worth in wherever I'm from, whether it be Arizona, Illinois, Georgia, Texas, whatever, Colorado, doesn't matter. It was all pretty much the same back in the day. And they usually wouldn't move. They wouldn't want to do it. You know, if their company was opening up a branch out here or just moving their offices out here, they just wouldn't want to do it. They wouldn't want to move to California because it was just so, so, so expensive. Now, that's what I call sticker shock. And what you're talking about is reverse sticker shock. But any comments on that?
Yes, I remember the same exact thing. And keep in mind, this was back in the 80s where pricing was a third of what it was today. But I'm sure you remember, as I do, back when interest rates were 13%, I think, when I started in the business. And in 1990, they dropped down to 10%. There was that whole flurry of refinancing because interest rates had dropped to 10% or just below 10%. And that was unheard of for the last 10 or 15 years prior to that. So even though prices were more affordable then, payments were higher because interest rates were higher. Today's interest rates make things so much more affordable. Plus, pricing outside of California is so affordable. It's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, people don't buy a property on the price, they buy it on the payment. But now you can really buy it on both. It's amazing, though, that a place like Birmingham, 46% of the population are renters, and they're in a bargain market. They're in a market they should be buying. One of my sayings, and the regular listeners have heard me say this before, but you know, I always say, invest in places that make sense so you can afford to live in places that don't make any sense at all. And oddly, we were both homeowners in Southern California, and now you are a renter in Southern California. I am a renter in Arizona in a high-end property here, and it just makes so much more sense to rent your own high-end home and to rent low-priced properties to other people who aren't smart enough or financially mature enough or willing to delay instant gratification enough to buy in that market, because they should be buying in Birmingham. They should be buying in Memphis. They should be buying in Atlanta. In all the markets in which we do business, it makes sense to own your own home there and to buy it. But fortunately, there's large renter populations. And with the current election, there's destined to be a lot more renters in the future as most of America grows a little bit poorer, frankly. So tell us about a specific property, though. You picked a proforma off the jasonhartman.com website here. And I mean, I can't believe how good the numbers look here. And by the way, we're going to talk about several other markets, folks. So just hold on for a few minutes. But let's just talk about a specific property in Birmingham.
All right, I'm looking at a property that's 1,536 square feet. It's 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. It's priced at $62,900. So with 20% down, you're looking at total cash, including closing costs, to close escrow of $17,863. It's renting for $900 a month.
Folks, before we move on to the rest of the performance, this is only $40 per square foot. $40 a square foot for a property that was renovated in October of 2012. Last month, it had a renovation. $40 a foot. Amazing. Okay, what's the projected rent here?
Projected rent is $900 a month, and the tenant will be in place when you close, so you'll be cash flowing from day one.
So pre-rented property, and the cash flow here is projected at $243 per month, or $29.16 annually. And here's the number that I just love. And Molly, what is the cash-on-cash return pro forma here?
It's 16%. It's just incredible.
16% annually. So folks, if the property goes down in value, which would be amazing if it's $40 a square foot, but say the economy just totally collapses, and this property is only selling for $20 per square foot, about 1/4 to 1/5 the cost of replacement or construction, in my estimation. And as long as you can maintain that income and expense ratio, you're going to get 16% cash on cash and an overall return on investment here of 31% annually. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Bargain price market, Birmingham. Anything else you want to say about that before we move to the next one?
No. A year ago, Memphis was, you know, a great marketplace where a lot of people were starting their investment properties. People have been kind of priced out of the Memphis marketplace, or inventories have come so low that Birmingham seems to be more of that starter investor community now.
Now, I'm surprised you're saying that. People are priced out of Memphis. I think Memphis is still a pretty low price market. I mean, the low price markets we have are Indianapolis, Memphis, and St. Louis, and Birmingham, of course. But Memphis, is that getting too expensive?
Well, okay, let me rephrase that. Maybe instead of being priced out, the inventory levels are lower and the prices are going up. So investors that purchased a year ago have seen great appreciation, and now they're going, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to pay this much more for the same property that I could have purchased a year ago for a much lower price.
So yeah, people get a little spoiled, because folks, you just have to realize the housing market has recovered pretty dramatically in the past year, and you just can't duplicate the deals you used to in any market. That just goes for everywhere. I don't know, maybe Detroit it's still a disaster, in my opinion. Maybe you can get the same deal you got there a year ago, but you can't in any of our markets. It's just you have to adjust your thinking. Let's look at a property in Indianapolis. And here, this property is brand new property. Now, before we do that, did you want to mention any highlights about Indianapolis, a market that's been perennially interesting to us? I own several properties there, and we've done lots of business there for many, many years, but maybe a couple just highlights on Indy to refresh people's memory, Molly.
Well, as you know, Indianapolis never really saw the bubble or the burst that a lot of the other metropolitan areas saw. So it's been a kind of slow and steady marketplace without a lot of drama, highs and lows. So it's always been a great place to invest. It also has a lot of education, healthcare, and finance. Plus, it's got great sporting events that bring in a lot of business. So it's that slow, steady, great opportunity city that it's just in the center of the country. It's a wonderful area.
Yeah, crossroads of America. One of the things I loved that you just said, you said it doesn't have a lot of drama. So I guess, folks, this might be the way to think of it when you're investing. When you invest with our philosophy, any town that wouldn't make for a good reality show is probably a good place to invest. Not a lot of drama, as Molly says. I love that. It's a pretty good way to look at it. Okay, well, this property without a lot of drama is just over 1,600 square feet. And looking at the pro forma here, priced at $104.9. And Molly, how much do you need to put down on this property?
Total cash invested with closing costs and 20% down is $21,819.
Okay, and you kind of cut out there for a moment. It's $21,819, and go through the rent projection and the cash flow.
The rent projection is $1,150 a month, and so that gives you a net cash flow of $338 a month or $4,056 a year.
Fantastic.
Which is huge.
Yeah, and based on this pro forma, the cash on cash return here, folks, 19% annually with some pretty conservative assumptions in the pro forma. And by the way, folks, you can just go look at these pro formas and see all of the numbers. There are dozens of numbers on them at jasonhartman.com in the properties section. But 19% cash on cash, property drops in value to zero. Maintain the income and expense, you'll get the cash on cash return. But the other thing to note is, say the property, in terms of an income and expense ratio perspective, only performs half as well as projected, your cash on cash return would be 9.5% annually. And that's before you get any tax benefits or any appreciation benefits or anything else. Okay, that's just cash on cash, the most simple form of measurement. And Molly, the overall return on investment projection there is
44%. And this is a brand new home, brand new construction. It'll be completed right after the first of the year.
44% annually. Fantastic. Okay, let's move to the greater Atlanta metro area now. And let's look at a property there and a couple of highlights. We had our Atlanta property tour just about a little over a month ago, I guess it was. But Molly, what are some of the highlights of this market? And then let's look at a great property there.
Well, as you know, it's one of the fastest growing metropolitan areas in the United States. It's headquarters to Coca-Cola, AT&T, and Delta Airlines. And 75% of the Fortune 1000 companies have some sort of a presence in the Atlanta area. And we had a great response, as you said, to our tour, and it's a booming area. It's a wonderful, wonderful area.
It is. And this is one of the markets, folks, that's it's really hard to get inventory in. But here is a property, and I love the looks of this property, by the way, that we have. This one is in Stone Mountain. Really, really nice looking house. Not that looks are the big deal here. What we're looking for is returns, but I'll admit it has some impact, no question about it. It's kind of like saying when someone's trying to fix you up on a blind date, well, she has a great personality.
Oh my God, you just took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Well, so this one is just over 1,700 square feet and $44 per square foot. Molly, go through some of the other details here.
This is $76,900. Total cash invested is $19,840. The gross estimated rent is $850 a month, which gives you a positive cash flow, $237 a month or $2,049 per year.
So almost $3,000 per year in positive cash flow based on the pro forma here. Again, assumptions very conservative. And cash on cash return, 14% annually. 14% annually cash on cash. And what's the projected overall ROI, Molly?
31%.
31% annually. Fantastic. So let's now talk about St. Robert, Missouri, a market in which I own. We've done a lot of business there over the years. And this is like one of these totally under the radar markets that nobody knows. It's got the big military base, Fort Leonard Wood, and the numbers are great. It's new construction. And Molly, one of the things I'd like you to highlight here is the special financing opportunities. So if anyone has maxed out and they've got their maximum number of 10 Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loans, or they can't do the sort of the conventional financing for one reason or another, in St. Robert, we do have some special financing opportunities, right?
We do. We have commercial financing, which, as you said, is a wonderful opportunity for people once they've maxed out those conventional loans. The way we usually work with our investors is that we put a program together so that they max out those 10 conventional loans first and then go into St. Robert and purchase either duplexes or fourplexes with their commercial financing. And the reason we recommend that is because if you do commercial financing before you max out your conventional loans, that commercial loan will count against you, against
right.
those conventional loans,
Very
even though
point.
It's not a conventional loan.
Yeah, right.
It's a catch-22.
And you're saying conventional in the sense that it's underwritten by Fannie Freddie. But what we call this, folks, that Molly just alluded to is mortgage sequencing. And we just did that with one of your clients a couple of months ago. We do it all the time. It's really nothing new. But mortgage sequencing is very important. You may shoot yourself in the foot when you're trying to build a big investment portfolio if you don't do your mortgage sequencing properly. And one of the things you mentioned, Molly, is duplexes and fourplexes. And I think the reason you mentioned that is because those are four units and under. Those are residential financing in terms of the way the banks look at them. However, you could do this type of thing with an 8, 10, or 12 unit small apartment building like I have there and do the same thing as well. So just fantastic financing. And I believe 10 years fixed, right, Molly?
I believe so.
Yeah. And at incredibly low rates, a little bit easier and more creative on the qualifying for these mortgages too, because they're underwritten with some common sense rather than just a rule book. So good things there too. So Molly, let's talk about one of the properties here in the greater St. Robert market. This is actually in Waynesville, and this is a duplex where you can get commercial financing, really good commercial financing. By the way, most commercial financing isn't that great. We've got a special relationship in this market, and the financing's really good on a commercial basis, a common sense basis. But talk a little bit about this one, 2,300 square feet. What else?
It's two bedrooms, two baths on both sides. It's $167,500. As you said, it's brand new construction. Total cash invested is $22,336. So that gives you a monthly cash flow of $258 or an annual cash flow of $3,096.
And we've got your vacancy factor, your management fees, everything built into these properties. Here are the cash on cash return projected at 14% annually, and the overall return, unbelievably good. What's the number, Molly?
43%.
Wow.
Huge.
43% annually. If it only goes 1/4 as well as we hope, you'll still be making 11% basically on your money. So that's just phenomenal. Well, anything else you'd like to mention, Molly?
We've got great properties, great areas, and great opportunities to invest. So it's a great time to be out in the marketplace, and it's a fun time to be out in the marketplace because things are stabilizing and interest rates are still phenomenally low, and it's time to be, as you say, an opportunist.
Yes, definitely be an opportunist and exploit the heck out of our situation with some good income properties. And basically, you're a commodities investor when you're doing this. So you've bought these commodities, you finance them for three long decades with fixed rate financing. And I mean, just what a phenomenal opportunity. What a phenomenal time to be a real estate investor. Really, really good stuff. Well, hey, Molly, thanks for talking to us about this today.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Before we go to our guest, I just wanted to make a personal announcement because many of you have known my cute little dog that attended many, many of our events, including Meet the Masters events and Creating Wealth seminars and so forth. Unfortunately, he passed away recently, and it's been a very, very sad time for me. In fact, I don't think I've ever had such a sad week in my life as after I lost Puppy. So I just thought if I can read it just to let you know what happened before we go to our guest here, I'll try reading what I posted on Facebook when it happened, if I can try not to get too choked up about it. November 4th, I said, "Thanks to everybody for the kind wishes and prayers for Puppy. Unfortunately, he left us this morning at 5 a.m. I adopted him from Orange County Animal Shelter on a rainy day over 13 years ago. I loved him like a son every one of the 4,962 days since. So what happened? He's been sick since Friday and visited his regular vet and the emergency vet twice, where I finally had to leave him in the ICU at midnight. The vet called and woke me around 4:15 a.m. saying it was probably my last chance to see him. So I rushed over and found him alive, but in a coma and not able to breathe without the ventilator. I made the decision to stop his sweet little heart since there was virtually no chance of recovery. Such a sad day. He will be missed forever." And then later that week, the following Friday, I was wrestling with the decision as to whether to cremate him or bury him. And I had three other dogs that I had in the past over the years and had buried at the Seabreeze Pet Cemetery in Huntington Beach, California. So I did decide finally to bury him in Arizona. And much to my surprise, there was only one cemetery for pets in all of the Phoenix Valley. So as you can imagine, it was rather expensive because they have a monopoly and no competition, something we've talked about on the show many times. And I just thought I'd read the memorial that I put on Facebook the day after his burial. And, you know, it really did bring some closure. And the last week I felt a bit better, or quite a bit less sad, even though I, of course, miss him very much. And I said on November 9th, I said, "Puppy's funeral was yesterday, ending our 13-year-plus earthly relationship. He was my companion for 4,962 days as we lived in five different houses, traveled to many places, outlasted six girlfriends, started 13 companies, and outlived my three other wonderful dogs. Thanks for the kind words, thoughtful deeds, and support. Friends have been saying that this will bring some closure. I hope so. This has been the saddest week of my life. I will love and miss him forever." And then I just ended with a quote by Anatole France that said, "Until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened." So for any of you dog lovers or pet lovers out there, dogs or cats, you know, I'm sure you understand it's a pretty hard time. So let's go to our guest, who is Sean O'Toole with Foreclosure Radar, an interview that I recorded, maybe about a month ago, maybe a little more than a month ago. And again, these interviews aren't necessarily super time sensitive. So the ones that are, we push them to the front, you know, when they were about the election and so forth, and we got those up faster. But this one wasn't as time critical. So it's maybe about, 4 to 6 weeks old, something like that, as I recall. So we'll go to that. But I also wanted to remind you, we have very few seats left for our Meet the Masters event, which is coming up January 18th in Irvine, California. So be sure to register for that. We probably only have, 10, 12 seats left for it. It's been selling very, very quickly. And register for that right away if you're planning on attending at jasonhartman.com. And we'll look forward to seeing you there. And again, thanks to all of you who knew about Puppy and for all of the kind wishes and sentiments and so forth. They are very much appreciated. And we'll be back with our guest with Foreclosure Radar here in just a moment.
Have you listened to the Creating Wealth series? I mean, from the beginning. If not, you can go ahead and get book one, that shows 1 through 20, in digital download. These are advanced strategies for wealth creation. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com.
It's my pleasure to welcome Sean O'Toole to the show. He is the founder and CEO of Foreclosure Radar, Foreclosure Truth, and ForeclosureLearningCenter.com. Welcome, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So you're up in Northern California, it looks like, right?
Yeah, we're actually based out of Truckee in near Lake Tahoe.
Fantastic. Well, your site is very well known. I learned about it several years ago. And you basically help people track the foreclosure market and see what's going on as foreclosures are going through the process. So a lot of realtors, investors, government people use the site?
Yes, absolutely. We've really differentiated ourselves by not only tracking the foreclosure notices, but also what happens at the auctions each and every day.
And tell us a little bit about it. I mean, so you track from the point of a notice of default, an NOD, or do you track delinquent payments even before it gets to NOD stage?
No, we do track the public records, so specifically the notice of default in the states where that's applicable, notice of trustee sale, and then the trustee deed after the sale. And then we also track what happens down on the courthouse steps. So is the sale postponed to a new date? Was it canceled or was it sold? And if it was sold, who did it sell to? To an investor or back to the bank, which has lots of uses, especially on the back to the bank one that gives you an early heads up on coming REOs.
And tell us your thoughts on the foreclosure market. Everybody's concerned about the inventory hangover. You're constantly hearing that phrase. And some say it's not as bad as others say it is. Give us some guidelines on that.
Well, they're both right, is I think the big answer. You know, we still have in this country far too many people underwater in their homes and delinquent in their payments. That said, though, they changed the rules really after the banking collapse in September 2008 in two ways. One, they changed the accounting rules to something from mark to market to mark to model, which allows the banks and various investors to leave these assets on their books at inflated valuations. And then the other thing was is they changed the regulatory framework such that banks and servicers weren't required to quickly foreclose on non-performing assets, instead could leave them on their books for an extended period of time. And ever since then, we've seen a steady decline in foreclosure activity, despite the fact that we still have this large hangover or shadow inventory, as some people like to call it.
There's still a problem. I mean, no one would deny that. Are things getting better?
Well, it depends on you know what metric you want to use. If you're looking at home sales and home prices, you know we have very tight inventory, you know, strong demand, multiple offers on properties in many markets. You know, so some people would say that's a sign of strength, and we've seen some price increases, which some people would say is great. You know, on the other hand, we have trillions of dollars of excess mortgage debt that are still left from the bubble years. That we're really making very little progress against, and we're likely to be dealing with lots of folks in kind of a negative position in their home for many years to come, which I think hurts the economy. And, you know, we'll probably have some impact on the housing market as well.
Are we going to inflate our way out of that? If you look at a market like Phoenix, where you see prices up about 30% from the bottom, it's pretty amazing that that's happening in this type of economy. So the question would be, and you know, my company does business in many, many cities across the U.S., and the question would be, did the down market, did it overcorrect? Was it really not quite as bad as we all thought? Were prices not maybe sticky enough as things were dropping? Or is this a temporary blip? Many people are accusing the banks of holding so much inventory and not dispersing it into the market because they say they're doling it out slowly so as not to hurt the market. But what do you make of all that?
Well, I think it really depends on the market. There's no question that some markets, the Phoenix area, Stockton, California, Las Vegas, overcorrected. And those saw a lot of investor interest and first-time homebuyer interest because they were at amazingly low prices that provided significant yields. Those yields have now begun to normalize. And so while some say, well, we still have low inventory and that's what caused prices to go up, I think it was just more of a yield normalization. And by that, I mean, given rents, you can get a decent return on investment. So, you know, in some of these areas, the return on investment at the bottom got as high as 15%. You know, now it's back in the 6-7% in many areas. And given that it's been investor demand primarily, I don't see those yields going a lot lower. So again, it depends on the market, but I think we've seen most of the bounce back in many of these markets. And I think looking at return on investment is a good way to judge where you currently are. On the other hand, we saw some markets not fully correct, and they probably still have some more to come down to come back down to reasonable affordability levels versus rents.
Right, right. And, you know, I would certainly say California is one of those markets. But when I talk to my real estate friends in Southern California, for example, they say the market's booming and they don't have enough inventory anymore. I mean, what a massive change. And believe me, you're in California. I live there virtually all my life. I am not bullish on California by any means, but it's just sort of shocking to see this, to get these kind of reports that multiple offers, people standing in line, builders holding auctions. I mean, what is this, 2005? You know, this is crazy.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, certainly in places like San Bernardino, Riverside, housing is at generational lows in terms of payments as a percentage of income. And so affordability is very high in some of these areas right now. And, you know, California is really a tale of two markets, right? One is those markets, San Bernardino, Riverside, up north, Sacramento, Stockton. And then you have on the other side, Malibu, San Francisco,
Newport Beach,
Palo Alto.
Yeah,
Newport Beach.
Sure. Yeah, those places.
Yeah, you know, those are two radically different markets.
Yeah, and you know what that tells me, by the way? That's interesting that you bring up that tale of two markets, because that tells me that we are again, it's another way to witness the destruction of the middle class, where the rich are doing okay. I'm not saying they're getting richer, but they're weathering the storm pretty well in most cases. And these poorer areas are just not, they've just been very, very beat up. I guess we'd call them former middle class areas, maybe.
You know, I don't think the story is completely, you know.
So it's a massive oversimplification. I'll be the first to admit. But
No, but I think you're onto something important. But I don't think it's completely rich versus poor in terms of income. You know, there is another difference, too, which if you look at some of those wealthier cities, the coastal cities, et cetera, you see a lot more property in those cities that have been in people's hands for a much longer period of time. There's less turnover. There's also far fewer new homes during the period of time that the bubble occurred. And, you know, so they were much more stable in terms of amount of equity, or one could say wealth, right, in real estate. And so there was less need or of turnover, and there was less foreclosures in those areas simply because you had fewer people that were as highly leveraged as you had in the, you know, booming subdivisions that were being built out in the cornfields of the
right.
Central Valley.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So fewer adjustable rate loans, fewer subprime mortgages. I mean, I look at that as like I look at some areas of Newport Beach and Corona del Mar, you know, where the homes have been in the family for a long time. And so, you know, that's certainly an aspect of it, an interesting one.
We even see that here around, you know, Lake Tahoe. But Lake Tahoe is decidedly, obviously, there's some very wealthy folks, but the majority of people that live here are very decidedly middle class.
And a lot of service industry, too.
A lot of service industry,
yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely. Okay. Well, what else would you tell us, and what else should we know about what's going on out there?
You know, I think the big thing is we just continue to see story after story of saying there's going to be a foreclosure wave. And, you know, I alluded to this right at the beginning, but, you know, the fundamentals have changed versus the 1990s, well, the last foreclosure crisis, where servicers, banks were required to get non-performing assets either off their books or performing. That's no longer true. And you add mark-to-model accounting on top of that, there's a lot of incentive to what I say, call extend and pretend. And, you know,
kicking the can down the road. Yeah. Tell us about extend and pretend. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, every day we hear Obama's asked banks to hold off on foreclosures until after the election or things
right,
like that.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have to ask. Those two rule changes are more than enough for the banks to follow the lead and do what is certainly in their economic best interest. You know, not foreclosing, especially for a servicer, is far more profitable in that they continue to collect servicing payments on non-performing loans. And that...
Yeah, so that's interesting you bring that up, because that really is a conflict of interest, isn't it? They're still getting paid for servicing this bad loan, and the servicer is the one, rather than the actual lender in most cases, dealing with the person who is defaulting. And so they may be fielding those phone calls, but their incentive is to just let it go, right?
Let it ride. And it's certainly not to foreclose or foreclose quickly. So, you know, I think people have this banks want to steal our homes thing. You know, anybody that's down on that path is, you know, I think completely out of their mind, because it's certainly not the way the game is set up.
Well, let me just maybe take a little bit of issue with that for a moment, if I may. I agree with you that it's not set up that way once you have a loan. But if you look at, if you back up and look at the much broader picture, you know, a lot of people, this is almost borders on conspiratorial, that you look at like the history of the investment banks on Wall Street. Goldman Sachs, a great example. The article in Rolling Stone magazine that got a lot of play, I'm sure you probably read it or heard about it a few years ago, accusing Goldman Sachs of being the giant bubble machine, which is literally like creating cycles in the market. And of course, the Federal Reserve and, you know, central banks in general, but as the run-ups in prices, you know, with easy money policy and then trading these huge pools of fake loans around the world and the game of hot potato and greater fool, maybe there's something to that. No, or do you disagree?
Wall Street exists to churn money and take a percentage of it, right?
Right.
And it doesn't
yeah.
really matter whether it's going up and down. A lot of people think they're there to help people make earnings over time, but I think that's absolutely BS. I mean, they're there to churn, and bubbles create churn. So absolutely, they're doing their best to create that churn and make fees off of it. But that's always been the case.
Right, right. But when they fill it up with a bunch of junk debt and they sell the same loan 33 times in 33 different pools, and it's not even really there, and no one can produce documents, I mean, that's not legitimate behavior, is it?
No, it's not. But, you know, I guess there's the question of who's really to blame. I mean, they're going to act in that way. They have since, you know, the 1800s. So, you know, which is why things like the Glass-Steagall Act and other things exist. You know, we as voters have become awfully complacent. You know, Glass-Steagall was repealed, back in 1999 or 2000. And, you know, where is the outcry from voters to put that back in place?
Yeah, it's a pretty minor outcry. So I agree with you. Okay. So you were saying the extend and pretend, any more to that aspect?
Well, you know, I just think that people really need to understand that that's the case. You know, shadow inventory absolutely exists, but it's not going to show up on our doorsteps. I don't think any time in the near future. I don't see any change coming. Even if we see a Republican president, Rahmi, elected, I think this policy of extend and pretend will stay the same. His announced housing policy is, you know, we should offer more foreclosure alternatives. Well, unless that's backed up with, and I know where to get the $2 trillion to help all those folks that are underwater, it's meaningless. And, you know, which I'd say for the current administration as well. So completely nonpartisan view there, but there are no ideas coming out of Washington at all.
Yeah, no, it's always two sides of the same coin. Unless you have Ron Paul, it's the same game to a one degree, you know, a lesser or greater degree, right?
Definitely see some very big differences fast with
yes,
Ron.
Yes, listen, I'm a big fan. In fact, I'm looking forward to having him on my show pretty soon. I think we're going to get him, so that's good.
I think it would be a far uglier than anyone imagines, but would put us back on the right track.
Yeah, yeah. It would be a painful pill to swallow, but we'd take our medicine in a few years, we'd probably be in really good, solid shape again. That's what I would kind of view it as. Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Now's your opportunity to get the Financial Freedom Report. The Financial Freedom Report provides financial self-defense in uncertain times, and it's your source for innovative, forward-thinking investment property strategies and advice. Get your newsletter subscription today. You get a digital download and even more. The price, only $197. Go to jasonhartman.com to get yours today.
But overall, I mean, I know that it's a mixed bag, and in a country as large and diverse as the United States, there are really about 400 housing markets. You know, it drives me nuts. I mean, my hair just curls when I'm looking at CNBC or reading the Journal or something like that. And, you know, I hear these experts talking about the, quote, housing market, unquote, because I can't figure out where the heck that is. But, you know, so it's obviously a mixed bag. And I really divide it this way, largely. Of course, there are many other factors, but I divide it into housing markets with high land values and housing markets with free or very cheap land, where investors at least are buying below the cost of actual replacement or construction. I know our clients are, and I know I am personally. So it's really like the country is a tale of two markets in that sense, maybe. And there are more than
two. True within foreclosures as well. We have the non-judicial foreclosure market and the judicial foreclosure market, and they're acting very differently.
Well, yeah, you know, that I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, tell us about the differences, non-judicial and judicial.
Yeah, I mean, the non-judicial market, because it doesn't require the court's involvement, you know, and a lot of people say, well, it doesn't give people a chance to say, to get their say or whatnot. That's not true. That's why there's a long notice period and plenty of time for people to intervene. But, you know, it kind of moves more quickly. And if you look at Arizona, it's one of the fastest moving foreclosure markets. And I think they're getting through their problems there faster as a result. Some of the other states have put up more legislation kind of slowing the foreclosure process, and by doing that, slowing the market's recovery. But the judicial process, where, you know, every single case goes through the court system, is, you know, a complete nightmare, and it's going to take far longer for those states to work their way through the system. You know, people talk about foreclosure mills like they're a bad thing, but they're pretty necessary once you start thinking about the volumes. That's led to a lot of controversy around things like robo-signing. But at the end of the day, the computer industry is a large part of the U.S. economy. And we trust our bank accounts to computers. And we trust just about everything else in our lives to computers, insurance policies, and everything else. And the idea that we can't trust a notice of default that was generated by a computer, and instead it has to be attested to by some $12 an hour employee to verify all the facts and sign with personal knowledge, it's kind of idiotic. There's been all these distractions in the foreclosure process that have really slowed it down, and I think slowed our recovery down, and I think some of them are completely nonsensical.
Yeah, well, you know, I would certainly agree with you philosophically. The same thing when it comes to government policy, because the government policy we've had is basically, you know, put the fire out by throwing more gasoline on it, printing more money. But, you know, and I think if we take the hard medicine, like we mentioned Ron Paul a few minutes ago, we would speed our way out of this problem. All we're doing is extending and pretending, really, to use your phrase. But, I mean, are you kind of like defending the MERS system, for example, when you say that?
You know, the MERS system made complete sense. The recording system in the United States is completely broken. I track public records that start at the county recorder's office. We have 3,250, I think, roughly, county recorders in the United States. Each has their own systems implemented. Some, you know, the San Francisco County Recorder, for example, which came out and said a lot of foreclosures are illegal, which was absolutely terrible analysis. But they tend to run 2 to 3 weeks behind from the date something's recorded to the date you can see it. A foreclosure sale legally happens before they even have the notice posted in their system. The recording system in the United States is completely broken. And yeah, I completely understand why the banks tried to build an system outside of that for tracking things as they change hands.
So I get that you understand and agree that there should be a better system. But I mean, the system we have, there are flaws. I mean, you know, a lot of people are, I've had people talk about MERS on the show and give examples of these clouded title issues and just huge problems with the system, wrong borrowers, wrong properties. I don't know that I can't even think of all the examples, frankly, but
I think one thing that's really common through this is the recording process, that entire process from title all the way through is subject to errors. I've personally bought properties and received title, and they made a mistake, and the APN was off a digit. I went to go sell it and, you know, had to resolve it. And, you know, so these wrongful foreclosures and the rest, it's It's human nature. No one's perfect. We're not perfect. People make typos. Title companies sometimes accidentally grab the wrong legal description and attach it to a deed of trust, which is why foreclosure processes throughout the United States provide ample time for people to say, wait, this isn't me. I'm not in foreclosure. I've made my payments. And there's plenty of opportunities for those folks to come forward. What I think is ridiculous is you get these anti-foreclosure folks using a handful of red herrings. You know, errors do happen. And then implying that all of these foreclosures are these other issues. And that's nonsensical. Look, with as many people that are underwater and as many people are delinquent, we should be having a large number of foreclosures. And 99 out of 100 are completely valid. The notion that because the deed of trust didn't change names at exactly the same time as the note, or there was some issue with the person who originated the note didn't transfer it correctly to the current holder of the note. The law has a long-standing concept around unjust enrichment, which is if Joe lent you money, right, and then Jim buys that note from Joe, and there's some problem down the line, it doesn't excuse Jill, who borrowed the money, from having to repay it. There's nothing in the law that suggests that anywhere, no matter what small mistakes were made or even large mistakes were made in the way the documents were handled. If that note gets burned up, right, there's cases many, many years ago where people tried to burn down the bank that held the note with their debt so that they wouldn't owe the debt anymore. And the law long, long, long ago said, no, even if the note's burned up, so long as you can show reasonably that you made the loan and the other person didn't buy the house free and clear, we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. If you can show that you put the money out and the person who owns the house can't show where they came up with the money, let me give you that benefit of the doubt. So I realize people are pissed off at the banks. I realize people are pissed off at Wall Street. There's no doubt they're responsible for this bubble. There's no doubt they're responsible for repealing Glass-Steagall. But setting aside decades of law just because we're angry isn't the right solution. We should be holding the banks accountable for these things. We should be holding politicians.
Well, obviously. No more career politicians. That's my first thing. But hey, you know, I wanted to ask you, and this is what I was we kind of went on a tangent here a bit. Your outlook, we started talking about the tale of two markets and talked about the land values and then the judicial versus non-judicial foreclosure markets acting differently. But what, just generally speaking, you know, I'd like to just kind of get your outlook on things. And we've touched on it, but do you think we've hit bottom? And I know that's a loaded question, so feel free to dice it up, but I'd like to get your feeling because you see this firsthand and you kind of have notice a tone of the sales and the pipeline and so forth. So just wanted to kind of ask you that general question.
Yeah, so big picture, I always look to the income approach to valuation, or, you know, rather than the comparable approach, right? There's multiple approaches to appraising properties. And if you look at the income approach, right, so what is it rent for? And if I take those rents minus expenses, what kind of return on investment do I get? And just think about the overall return, not assuming leverage, right, not assuming that you're borrowing anything to buy the house. And look at that and then think about what a reasonable return is for that area. And if it's prime oceanfront property in one of the, you know, most economically strong areas of the country, you'd expect a pretty low return on investment, you know, something down to where treasuries are, a couple of percent return, right? If on the other hand, it's in an area where you're likely to get shot in a drive-by shooting, I personally would want a pretty high return on investment, maybe 20% or more. And so if you think about that, and then you just think about and compare it to other investments, right? And then you think about, is this particular area, this market that I'm in, is it economically sound? Does it have a good base of employment? Is employment increasing or decreasing? So what's that future look like, right? And I think where you can do really well in real estate is when you buy into an area that is economically strengthening, where incomes are rising, and you're starting from a point where you have a good return on investment to start, I think you will always do well in those areas. On the other hand, you think about a place where industry is declining, like Detroit.
Yeah, I was just going to mention the poster child for political disasters and union disasters, Detroit. Yes.
is exactly the opposite. I mean, thing there that only a bulldozer will fix. So I think it's a pretty simple equation at the end of the day. Look at that ROI, compare it to what you'd get on a return elsewhere, and then look at the local economy and is it improving or declining.
Good stuff. Well, hey, give out your website if you would, Sean, or which, you know, you have three of them. Do you want to just talk for a minute about those three websites and what you're doing with all of them?
Yeah, so foreclosureradar.com is our primary our website where our business is located, and it's targeted towards realtors, investors, government agencies. We track all the foreclosures in California, Arizona, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, as well as not only just the public records notices, but the auction outcomes as well. And then we also have a blog called foreclosuretruth.com. And on the blog, we put up our latest foreclosure reports and from time to time, you know, interesting analysis. For example, we were the first to see a divergence between how long it was taking to foreclose on low-end homes versus higher-end homes. And, you know, saw that banks were more likely to foreclose if you had equity or if you had a lower price home and more likely to postpone or delay.
That's interesting. Can I comment on that? I've always said that equity makes you a target for foreclosure as well as litigation, other problems. So that's why I love the idea of equity stripping. You know, just yeah, I love investment property, but I like it leveraged. Oddly enough, and it's counterintuitive, most people think more equity makes you safer. I think less equity in many ways makes you safer. And just look at who's getting all the bailouts, the people with no equity or being underwater. The other thing, though, about that lower price and higher price properties, one possible aspect to that is not that the banks are playing favorites and foreclosing on lower end borrowers sooner, because I'm sure in our politically correct society, someone will probably has made a big issue of that. But it's that wealthier people, they know how to fight the fight. They might hire a lawyer, they might hire a loan modification firm, they might do it themselves. They'll run the gauntlet with the bank possibly, whereas the less sophisticated person won't. I mean, is that a reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, you know, that's a possibility. We've also theorized that we know that banks actually are more likely to own the higher end loans. Where the lower
sell them off. Yeah, good point.
So it also may have something to do with needing to maintain their capital ratios and be able to pass solvency tests. So,
in other words, what you were saying is the higher end loans, the jumbo loans, or even the super jumbo loans, are left in the bank's portfolio. They haven't sold them off to another investor.
It's more likely,
right? That's right. Yeah, very good point. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
On the being over leveraged thing, there's an old saying that if you owe the bank a little money, the bank owns you, and if you owe the bank a lot of money, then you own the bank.
That was probably a takeoff on the J. Paul Getty saying, where he said, "If you owe the bank $100, that's your problem. If you owe the bank $100 million, that's the bank's problem." It's kind of funny, huh? Well, good stuff. Did you explain two or all three of your websites now?
We just have the two.
So there's Foreclosure Truth, Foreclosure Radar, and another one.
No, the Learning Center is part of Foreclosure Radar.
Ah, okay, got it. Good. Well, Sean O'Toole, thank you very much. Interesting talking with you. And, you know, we'd love to have you back on the show in the future for another update as things progress, or dare I say, regress. I hope they don't. But thanks for joining us today.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.